Backstage with Robert Emery.
Hello and welcome to episode number 8 of the Backstage with Robert Emery podcast. I'm so thrilled today to be interviewing the BBC presenter Jamoke Fashola. Jamoke is a fascinating person because she's become successful not only in her radio presenting and television work, but also in the world of theatre and as a classical singer and as a mainstream jazz artist. And there's not many people in the world who can cross all of these cultural arts and become successful and also have the authenticity that you need to be able to do that. She has an incredible story, and her top tips of being productive and being successful in life and being motivated in life are so fantastic that I'm actually creating a PDF which will be on the Robert Emery website because I think they're a brilliant mantra for anybody to live by. But without further ado, here we are. Here's the conversation with Jamoke Fashola. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me today. So we were just talking about where we met, and I think it was on a David Bedella gig many moons ago now.
Many moons ago, yeah. And, big David Bedella fan.
Yes, so. And you were, I think, doing a guest spot as a singer.
Yeah, I can't, possibly. Yes, I did do one. I remember doing one. Gosh, that was quite a while
ago. Yeah, it was quite a while ago now. And actually, I only ever, when I first met you, I just thought you were a singer, a performer, and that's all you did. And we got in contact recently and I invited you onto the podcast, which you gratefully accepted. And the more I look into you, the more I'm fascinated. When I look at your website, you're labelled as a broadcaster, journalist, vocalist, and a live literature curator, which is just an incredible array of talents. And we were already chatting before we started recording about being pigeonholed and put into a box.
Yeah.
And that's something which you definitely are not put into any box, because you've got such a sort of wide variety of talents. But I first just want to talk a little bit about theatre.
Yeah.
Because I know you started off in theatre, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
So what was that? And what did your parents think of that?
Oh, gosh, right. So I was born in the UK, but I lived in Nigeria for a while. My parents are Nigerian. And at one point, I probably around the age of 14 or something like that, I decided I wanted to be an actress. And I come from a pretty conservative family. And my mother decided to call a family meeting as an act of protest. Like, no, you will not disgrace the family. So I had to sit in this family meeting where the entire family, and I'm talking extended family here, and if anyone knows anything about Nigerian families, or any families, I suppose, but, you know, we've got a pretty big family. And they just, people went in, like, no, you can't, you should be a doctor, you should be, I mean, it's a pretty typical sort of response, I think, to a certain degree, but it was like, you need to be a doctor, a lawyer, a nurse would be better than being an actress, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Why? What was their reasoning?
Just that it's just not done. It's not done to be, it was just seen as this kind of flyaway type of career. But the funniest thing about it was my mother, who called the meeting, because there was all these people arrayed and everybody had an opinion. In the end, she just went, oh, forget it. Just let her do whatever she wants to do. So in a way, it worked for me. And also, I've always been strong-headed. So I started there. So I started acting in Nigeria. And I started doing television in Nigeria, but presenting and actually doing, you know, sitcoms and things like that. So there was a point in Nigeria where I'd walk down the street and people would be like, oh, you know, that's so-so-so, because I was in all these sitcoms and I was present, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I think when my mother, who sadly has passed away, saw me on television, it suddenly kind of went, oh, it'll be all right.
Yeah, you'd made it.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
I hadn't really, but...
Yeah. So why did you move back to the UK?
So I came back to study interior design. So I went to the Inchbald School of Design, which is in Sloane Square.
Okay, sorry. Stop right there. Sorry. See, this is the thing that I'm fascinated by. So you were doing, you were a TV actress, and you were doing really well in Nigeria, and you chose to move back to the UK to study interior design.
Yeah, you know when people are asking about your life and you think, oh, my life is boring, but, you know, it might be of interest. essentially I was doing really well, but I think I got to the point where, well, someone actually said, oh, actresses are brainless. Now this was a thing. I can't remember how I got into this conversation. It was a long running conversation with someone, and I just thought, well, actually I can do other things. So, and then the opportunity came up to go to the Interpol, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to go back to the UK. And then I went to the Interpol with all these lords and ladies, and it was great fun. I love interior design because I'm fascinated by design and art, and as a creative, I see myself as a kind of holistic creative. So I'm fascinated by art in general, whatever that creative. So I went along and did that. And then did some work in it, but wasn't quite. I love, like, my house is completely about design and art and stuff, but I don't think I was necessarily going to be the world's best interior designer. And my heart has always been in music, in theatre and things like that. So, and in presenting. And so I kind of came back to what was my first love.
Mm. And how did you get back into the business? Because it's, I know it's difficult from a music point of view if you dip out for a year or so because you take a break or you had a baby. It's really tough to get back in. So how did you get back into the business? What was your
route? Do you know, I am one of those people who I really believe that when you have a, when it's your calling, so I have this spark inside me that says it will always happen. I always live in hope. It's a really weird thing. Not consciously. I just kind of like if I get anxious about anything, I just remember all the times where I've had these magical connections. And I can't remember. I think I was asked to appear as a guest on a television program. I can't remember why, but I did. And that producer said, oh, you might be good for something else. And that was how it snowballed. And next, you know, Jane Moat got in touch with me about the holiday program. It was a really, so I know people often say, oh, you know, I've had to do this really hard graft. And I have had to graft. But it in an interesting way, it's almost as if here's an opportunity. Are you willing to step into it? So it was just a kind of series of odd connections, really, and not necessarily people I knew, just, you know, once again, that whole thing about being nice to everybody helps, and courteous. I think it's just not even nice, but just being courteous to everyone. It just, as far as I recall, that was how it started, snowballed again.
And what was your first experience in radio? Do you remember that?
I had been doing I'd just done the holiday program, and then I'd done Songs of Praise. So I was reporting for the holiday program, and then I was presenting a series called Summer Praise. And someone got in touch with me to say, we're looking for a presenter for our Sunday show. Would you be interested in coming in and having a conversation? Which I did. And then they were like, well, let's try you. And I think I've been there ever since. at least at BBC London.
And do you remember what that tryout was? Did you have to sort of do a fake recording?
I basically had to bring in the music, and I had to do the show. So I had to do a show, and then they then said, okay, let's try it out for a few months or whatever. And then, that was how it started.
And how long ago was that?
Quite a long time ago.
And what do you... So you now do two radio shows, don't you? You do BBC London.
Yeah.
And you do...
I do BBC Radio 3. I do J to Z on BBC Radio 3, which is a Saturday afternoon show, which is a rolling presenter chair alongside Kevin Legendre and Julian Joseph.
And what do you have to do to prepare for your radio shows? Because, I mean, they're very different, aren't they?
They are very different. So my Sunday breakfast show is a news, primarily a news programme with music is the way I put it. So the first, and chat. So it's basically an interactive show. People can call in whenever they want to discuss the topics. So we set up some topics. We have guests. The last half hour is all about arts. The first hour is probably music and chat with the listeners. The middle part of the show is all about news, so it's driven by a news agenda. So it could be anything that's happening in the news.
And who chooses what your topics are for the day? Is that you?
So it's a producer? Yeah. So it's a mutual kind of thing. I have a producer. The news agenda is pretty set by what's in the news. Mm. Although we choose what's appropriate for a Sunday morning, depending, yeah. and then also whatever is in the papers. But then I spend a lot of time looking for ideas about subjects that we might then have a conversation about. And when I come in first, I mean, I get up at 3:30 on a Sunday morning, so people may think it's glamorous, but it's not glamorous at all. You get in, and then you go through the papers and decide, you know, what are topics you're going to choose. And sometimes you choose a topic, it doesn't quite work, or it evolves into something because someone calls up. I mean, the best thing about it is that there's, you know, complete interaction with the audience. So the audience, it's a really fascinating thing to hear people's viewpoints, particularly at that time in the morning where they're pretty laid back.
Mm. And so you do all of this directly before you go live.
So the show is set up probably through the week. So I get my briefing on a Friday. Yeah, primarily on a Friday. And then the topics and stuff are set up on the morning.
Wow. So it's a very early start.
It's a very early start. It's, you know, it's slightly antisocial. I mean, if people invite me out on a Saturday night, it has to be well worth my going up, of thing. Yeah, but I used to also do the late night show on BBC Radio London. So I used to have to do 4 hours. My Sunday breakfast show was 3 hours, 4 hours between 10 and 2. And that was 4 nights a week. I mean, that completely ruined me. I mean, that was a killer. So this is almost a walk in the park, but not quite.
Yeah, I bet. And for your BBC Radio 3 show, J to Z, what's the setup with that and how do you prepare for that?
So that's an independent production. It's a Radio 3 show. I have a producer. I choose some music. They choose some music. We have a guest that tells us about their inspirations. It's always fascinating. So you name any jazz musician who's really doing something, not necessarily that well known, but doing something, we have them on the program and they talk about four or five of their choose three or four tracks. I mean, and someone goes out and records them talking about the things that they find inspiring. And then I come in and link it all together. Mm. So, you know, I've chosen some music, I'll write some scripts, my producer writes some things, you know, so it's a collaborative. And then sometimes we have a live in studio. So we go up to the top of Old Broadcasting House and have full band in, live interview and all of that. And we've just been at the Radio 3 Free Thinking Festival. So we did a live broadcast from there. So yeah, it's a mixture of lots of things.
I mean, radio presenting is one of these skills that on the face of it seems like a really easy job to do. But I know from my limited experience, it's absolutely not. It's incredibly tricky. What do you think are the real challenges about presenting on radio?
Well, if you're doing live, you just have to have your finger on the button. You have to have your ears open. You have to, for anyone, and I'm sure lots of people have been in radio studios, seen pictures of radio studios, when you're doing a live show, you've probably got about 5 screens in front of you. All those screens contain information and you are constantly looking at each screen to work out particularly if you drive yourself, which is you are operating your own desk.
And do you do that?
Yeah, I do. So you're making sure that you're going out on air, you're making sure the guest microphones are up, you're doing all this stuff, you're checking out social media, so even though you've got a producer, you also have your own sort of little kingdom that you have to deal with. And then you also have to be kind of thinking about what are you asking this guest? Why is this person interesting? What are they saying that might lead off into a different thing? So the art of being technical and listening, I think, is probably one of the challenges. I think the other thing is that I love talking to people. So I enjoy the notion of sitting and having a chat, but you also have to keep bear in mind that I'm not, unlike I suppose what we're doing now, you are very time conscious. So you're looking at your clock going, okay, I've got 10 minutes with this person or 5 minutes or whatever it might be. And I need to ask X, Y, Z questions. And then because I do a mixture of what is art or culture and I do news, you've got very two very different agendas riding, you know, layering on top. So I've been doing it for so long, I don't, in a way, I haven't thought about the complexity of it, but if when I'm talking to you now, Robert, I'm like, it is complex.
Sure. It's just second nature to me.
It's second nature to me now. But I do remember when I first started just being like, how do you do all of this all at the same time? It is a bit, but then I suppose it's a bit like driving a car. There's a point where your brain goes, I know what I'm doing, or your muscle memory knows what it's doing.
Yeah, sure. And have you now backed away completely from theatre?
No. And in fact, last year, I did, I appeared at the Arcola Theatre as part of an ensemble cast for a thing called Lola Chaunet's The Secret Lives of Babasegi's Wives, which got rave reviews in all, you know, like the Guardians. Yeah. It was very nice to kind of be. But that was also, it was very interesting because I tend to layer things. So what had happened at that point was I'd been asked to do the show and I said yes, which was like a seven-week run, you know, the normal 8 shows a week, completely sold out type thing, 4 weeks, 3 weeks rehearsal, whatever it was. So learning a script, which I hadn't done in a long time, was like, oh my gosh. And then I had just been, it had just been announced that I was doing the Radio 3 thing. And then I was also doing my Sunday breakfast show. So there was a moment. And then I was also running my Jazz Fest jukebox. There was a moment where I was literally, it was like a layered cake. Like you wake up and you just like, what is it I need to do now? Mm-hmm. Just, you know, compartmentalize it. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tricky thing about being a self-employed person in the entertainment industry, juggling all these balls. And when you've got one job and one gig on the go, you're always trying to line up the next one.
Absolutely.
And keep moving, really.
Yeah.
So you still love theatre, but is that putting you out of your comfort zone a little bit now, theatre, because you don't do it as often as radio?
Yeah, I think theatre was a bit of a shock when I went back and did I'd done something a couple of years prior, which was at the Lyric, and then, but it wasn't a very long run. It was probably maybe a week or two. But this was a 7 week, 8 shows a week. And it was an eye opener. And also because it's a lot of music in it, which was lovely. But the main thing was that it was a lot of words. Yeah. Just like, and also, you know, so it's again getting in that rhythm where, and I always remember that every time I went to theater, I would be going on the train because it was at the Arcola, so I could go overground. And I literally would walk along the road saying all my lines as I went, you know, so like everyone became a bit of a ritual. Like I had to, as before I got onto the train, I had to be able to, you know, complete X, Y, Z. And there were moments where it was uncomfortable. I mean, I think when we first started rehearsals and I realised that some of the words hadn't gone into my brain was like, oh my gosh, you know. But then after a while, it just becomes, again, second nature. I think the worst thing is when you're tired and you know, you still have to give your 110%.
It is tiring, isn't it? Doing 8 shows a week, it's
really
nappery.
Yeah, actually. And there was dance and there was singing and it was all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
And talking about going out of your comfort zone, you were telling me that you've just been doing the Bach St. John's Passion, which, I mean, you know, that's a tricky piece for anybody who doesn't know it. It's, you know, that's very tricky. And you sang the role of the tenor.
Yeah, I sang the evangelist role,
Indeed.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think this is incredible you did this because you don't read music.
No, I don't. I mean, I kind of look, I can, you know, it's going up, it's going down, I can plunk it out on the piano, but I can't pick up a score and suddenly go, which, I mean, I envy anyone who can do that. I don't. I mean, I suppose 2019, I was like, well, let's make it your year of yes and try and say, okay, let's do this. But I think I was slightly blasé.
Yes, like, well.
I was blasé when I said yes to this. And I was like, I listened to it. And I mean, I do love classical music. I can't tell you, you know, knots and bolts, but I do love classical music. So I was like, oh, this sounds really lovely. So I went yes. And then, it took 2 months of just literally every single day trying to get it into my brain. And I think, I mean, it has improved my musical confidence tremendously, but there were moments where I literally, the repetiteur would sit and they go, they play the chord. Because so essentially anyone who doesn't, if you don't know St. John's Passion, it's recited. So essentially you play a chord and you're the conductor, so you would know, you can explain this much better. But to me, the ordinary Joe Block singer, they play a chord and off you go.
That's exactly it.
Is that right? Okay, yeah. And then they play another chord, yeah. And off you go. Yeah. And Bach never makes it easy. So you will have maybe three or four lines that are exactly the same in terms of words, but completely different in terms of the way he wants them sung. I've never been so frustrated in my life. And I remember going in once to the repertoire and saying, okay, and she played this chord and I went, nothing. I just like literally, there was nothing. I reached for it and I was like, I have no idea. I'm not sure I would say I'd enjoyed that experience. I did once, but then once you've got the orchestra and you've got the choir, it was lovely to hear their response. Because when you were working by yourself or with one other person, you're thinking, is this really going to work?
Was it nerve-wracking? Do you get nervous?
Yeah, I mean, I think nerves are good. To a certain degree, it was nerve. I think the first rehearsal was nerve wracking because I was like, "Whoa!"
Yeah,
and then and it was only one performance. I mean, that was the other thing. So there was no kind of come back and do it again. You know, you had to kind of land on it. But I in retrospect, I'm very proud I did it.
I mean, just looking at information about you online and. One of the things on your website says that from a music point of view, you love Handel to Bach, Gershwin to gospel.
Yeah.
You're inspired by Diana Ross, yeah. Nina Simone. One of the first pieces of classical music you were introduced to as a teen was the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a massive wide range of genres of music, which from my point of view is really refreshing because so many times people ask me as a musician, what is your favourite piece of music? And I genuinely don't have one because there's so much music I like.
Of course.
I could probably point you, you know, my top five favourites in each genre or something, but, you know, I don't have an overarching favourite. And looking at your wide range of music, where did you get that from? Was that from being a child and you listened to different types or...?
Well, actually, weirdly enough, we weren't a musical family. So I think my parents probably listened to me. I mean, I do recall my mother and my father dancing in, you know, to something or the other when I was young. But we weren't one of those families that, you know, they didn't take you to dance lessons or anything. We didn't have any of that. I think I just loved it. I think, and I think my musical taste and accumulation of the people that I've met throughout my life. So I, for instance, jazz was about an old boyfriend who used to bring me a mixtape every so often and say, listen to this and decide which ones you like and which ones you don't. So he would bring me a Charlie Parker and then he'd bring me this and he'd bring me that. And I'd be like, oh, you know, I like some of this and some of that I love. And that was my journey into jazz. The classical, I had a distant uncle who was, one of my uncles, a distant uncle, he is a classical composer, but African classical composer. And when I was studying, he was very much about, oh, please learn to sing classical. I had no interest. I mean, I think this is a bugbear. He was like, it would really be good if you could just, you know, you could be like, and I'd be like, nah, I want Nina Simone. I'm not interested in, you know, being a Jesse Norman who I've met and who I adore and, you know, who I just think is extraordinary. But at the time, if you'd given me Jesse Norman versus Nina Simone, I've gone, Nina Simone, thanks very much.
Yeah.
But then he slowly introduced me to things. I had another, I have a big extended family. So another distant uncle, we call, you know, people who are older than us in Nigeria call them uncle. A distant uncle who was very much into Berlioz, and he was a French professor, so he was very much about. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. So it's kind of those kind of influences. So there's never very anything specific. I didn't go to school and go, oh, you know.
Did you have voice training? Did you have singing lessons?
Not till later on. Okay. You know, initially it was just, oh, I'm naturally talented. Right. Now I think about it, no, you weren't, but you know, that's okay.
And talking about Nigeria, when was the last time you went back there?
I went back about 3 years ago. Went to host some sort of jazz festival in the middle of Nigeria. But yeah, I mean, and it's really interesting to go back and think about all those influences and also the way the music has evolved and changed. And just get that sense of that vibrancy. And there's a growing movement now about African classical music, which is really fascinating. Yeah. To hear those conversations about how people are now recognizing all some of the African composers who really did have an impact here in the UK. I mean, there's like Shoande and there's Akinyuba, and there are lots of people who, you know, exploring that kind of music. So that's been quite interesting as well.
I mean, it seems very hot at the moment. I'm going to a couple of conferences. I'm going to Rotterdam next week for one, and Cannes in a couple of weeks' time. And there's quite a few talks about African classical music and and how it's been developed even more and becoming more popular and what people are doing with it. And it's really interesting that it really has struggled to come over, particularly over to, you know, places like the UK and the States. And, you know, it hasn't really penetrated here yet, but it seems to be starting to do this.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, everything is of its time. And even in Africa, in Nigeria, in places where that music was developed, wasn't necessarily recognised. So there have been people who have made forays here in the UK, but as its own genre, I think it's only slowly coming into the fore. And it's interesting to hear as well about how do you marry the roots of, if you like, the roots of where people come from, and whether or not that has an impact on the music that they make, you know. So I think there's some very fascinating I'm not an expert at all, but there's some fascinating conversations about what that flavor, if you like, has on classical music, and I'm fascinated to see what might happen next with it.
You've released your own album back in 2014.
Yeah.
The Condition of Being a Woman.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore that title. I think it's a phenomenal title for an album. Tell me a little bit about that. I've taken a listen last night. But I just wanted you to sort of describe for the listeners what your style of music is.
Ooh.
It's difficult. It is difficult.
I mean, that album is all about, here comes the British
here
rain.
Here comes the rain. So I'll just close the door a little bit.
That album is all about, I suppose, music that I liked, but also music that spoke to me as a woman. So, do you know Tim Sutton? His musical director. Oh, gosh, he's astonishing. He really is. He's like a musical director, composer. He does lots of West End stuff. He's done a lot of work at the National. The first song on that album is called I Am a Stranger, which he wrote. And actually, funny enough, sounds completely different from what, you know, when we first met, because one of my vocal coaches was Mary King, and he had come along to do some musical conducting for her, I think. He's brilliant. You really should check him out. Anyway, so there's a song on that from him. There's some Nina Simone stuff on that. There's a couple of things which entwine music, sort of like jazz, but also there's a Wayne Shorter piece on there, but also in Bring Along Poetry, which is my other love. I don't write poetry, but I adore poetry, so I'm fascinated by that. There are a couple of originals on there. So it really is about, I mean, I don't know how to describe it. So I suppose it's a combination of,
I suppose it's a bit like you, a bit of an eclectic.
Yes, it's really eclectic. I should have called it eclectic. Yeah.
And you You crowdfunded this album.
Yes, I did.
Didn't you? I mean, yeah. Is that quite tricky? I've never done anything like that.
It was really tricky.
Yeah.
There was a moment I thought, I'm just not going to complete it. It was really tricky. It's not the easiest way to do it. Albums cost money. I mean, I think, and you would know this, because of the way the music industry is changing, it's really, unless you're signed, and even when you're signed, there's no guarantee of anything. So this was, you know, a self-funded or crowdfunded album. I mean, essentially what you're asking people to do is buy the album in advance. That's essentially what you're asking them to do. Yeah. So buy an album in advance, or you might get a couple of, you know, different little things if you pay a bit more, but essentially buy the album in advance is what you're asking people to do. And you kind of need a whole village in order to do that. Basically, it's not an easy thing. I mean, we managed to do it, and it was, but it really was about, hey, you know, I really want to do this. I'm glad we did that album. I don't think I'd crowdfund an album now. I think I would try and, you know, pay for it myself.
Yeah.
Because, and then just, so my notion of, for instance, I want to do another album is make the money, do the album, but make the experience of doing the album so worthwhile doing the album that if nothing else comes of it, I've had an experience of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, I've done, I don't know, 7 or 8 albums in the past 2 years. 4 of which have gone straight to number 1.
Wow. We are not worthy to be in your presence, my love. Yeah.
But, you know, but all of them have been released on an independent classical or on an independent label, and all of them have been self-financed, apart from one which was financed by Sony. And all of the clients I had, the primary goal was to have the best time of your life making the album.
Yeah.
And you don't do this every day.
No.
So it's something which you cherish, you work hard at,
yeah,
but you love every minute of it.
Yeah.
And I think all of the artists who I've worked with have turned around and said it's one of the best things they have ever experienced in their life. And I guess probably just over half of them have broken even on the cost of the albums, and the cost of these albums incidentally range anywhere from 30,000, and the most expensive one I've done is about 600,000.
Wow.
So, you know, a big range of budgets. But they've loved every second of doing it, and I think that shows in the product at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I really believe that. And I think this is the reason for doing it. If you don't really love creating the music, what's the point?
Well, exactly. And also because you might be able to recoup, at least if you break even, that's a great thing. But I think many people probably will never see that money back. And so you kind of have to go, let me have something that makes me feel it was worth all the blood, sweat and tears.
Yeah.
And I suppose, and I work in an area primarily when it comes to music, which is predominantly jazz or contemporary. And you know, there's no real money in jazz.
No, not unless you're Chick Corea.
Unless you're Chick Corea, and even then, you know, you're still having to tour.
Yeah.
And well, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine last night out to dinner, where we were talking about some people that this person knows, and they're saying they made these albums, and none of them were sold at all. You know, so you had all these CDs. I mean, so also the way technology is changing is having an impact on how you present the music. So you could say, oh, well, everybody's into vinyl. But actually, ironically, you know, we were having this conversation yesterday saying they printed all this vinyl and nobody bought any vinyl.
Yeah.
Excuse me, at a gig.
Yeah.
Nobody bought the CDs, nobody bought any vinyl. So
very niche.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you really have to figure out, well, it's going to be a download thing. And if it's going to be a download thing, it's going to take you many years, if at all, to ever recoup your money.
Unless you're Ed Sheeran, who I saw in the papers this morning, has become the has earned more money this year from the entertainment business than anybody else in the UK.
I've had Ed Sheeran play, you know, way before he was massive, you know, playing live in our studio. And I think he's incredibly talented. But I also think that there is a momentum behind him. There's a momentum that he has created and has tapped into. Mm. You know, you have to study those kind of people and think, how have you managed to do this? I personally, as a musician, don't want to be an Ed Sheeran. In terms of, I don't think I'm ever going to make millions. So that's not the reason why I do it. And, you know, it's one of the things I do, thankfully. I think if I was just a solo musician, I'd be weeping into my coffee. I'd be like...
Yeah, it's really tricky.
It's incredibly tricky. And I admire anyone who is starting out now and saying, I want to be a musician or whatever, because the landscape has changed so much.
Yeah, and it will continue. I mean, I was in Switzerland last week with a colleague of mine and speaking to his wife about their children, and their youngest really wants to become an actor.
Okay.
And I think as parents, they're potentially a bit worried about this, because trying to earn a decent living, a stable living as an actor, can be incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, from an arts perspective, being an actor and being a musician, I think, are equally as tough as each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to them, my only advice here is, if that's his burning desire, if that's what passion is in his heart, and that's what he's been put on this earth to do, you've got to, exactly like you were saying at the start of this conversation, you've got to have this internal sense of belief that it's going to turn out all right, and you've got to have this self-motivation. And if that's what his passion is in life, I think you have to support that, because, you know, to be the next Sir Ian McKellen or to be the next Ed Sheeran, where you do earn a considerable amount of money and live a very nice lifestyle, there are far and few people who do that. But nevertheless, there are people who do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ed Sheeran 7 years ago was unknown.
Yeah.
He could have been sitting at this table saying, I'm a struggling musician. Sure. So you just don't know. So I think it's got to be about what's in your heart and having this sense of self-belief. Talking about that, I just want to divert for a second and tell you an interesting story about having this belief.
Yeah.
When I was 10, I came to London for the first time ever. I grew up near Birmingham.
Right.
I'm a Brummy boy. I got rid of the accent.
I'm sure it comes back when you land there.
Yeah, no comment. And my, believe it or not, my swimming teacher, who as a 10-year-old I was absolutely in love with, Caroline, her name was. I remember her quite specifically for some reason. And I said I was going to marry her. She was the love of my life as a 10-year-old. And she said, what do you want for your birthday? And I said, well, I want to go to London. I want to see a show. I'd never seen a musical. So I came to London. I went to the Palladium and saw Joseph.
Wow.
First show I'd ever seen. Absolutely loved it. And there was a dude who was sitting right at the bottom, who was waving a stick, conducting. And I didn't really know what a conductor did then. I knew vaguely he controlled the music. And I looked in the program and it said musical director Mike Dixon, musical supervisor Michael Reed. I didn't know what the difference was. I didn't know who that man was down there. But as a 10-year-old kid, I circled these two people. And I still have the program today. And I wrote in this program, this is what I want to do when I grow
older. That's amazing.
Cut to 8 years later, I get a place at the Royal College of Music and I move down to London.
Yeah.
And the first week, I'm at the RCM looking on the notice board for jobs. And it says jobs. Underneath it says, please do not remove these advertisements. They are for all our pupils and students to see. And I saw this job playing the organ in Chiswick, which was just down the road from where I was staying.
Right.
I thought, that's perfect. And right. I promptly ripped it down, put it in my pocket.
So that no one else can
so
get it.
I know, really naughty. Yeah. And I phoned this bloke up and he said, he's funny. You're the only one who's phoned us. I don't, well, you know, come along for an interview. So I came along and played the organ for them. And he said, yeah, you got the job. It's great. And on the first Sunday, the vicar said, Robert, there's somebody I'd like you to meet. And walked down the aisle, this guy called Mike Dixon,
wow.
who happened to be a musical director. And it turns out he was the one who was conducting Joseph. And I thought, well, the stars are looking down at me today. I mean, I can't believe this. And so I got talking with him and you know, he's remained a friend ever since. And the following week, the vicar said to me, there's somebody else who I'd like you to meet. And down walked Mike Reed.
That was ridiculous.
I know. And I said, well, I can't believe it. I met Mike Dixon last week and now I'm meeting you, and you are the two people in my program. I mean, this is like the stars are aligning. And Mike Reed actually gave me my first proper job.
Wow.
You know, I worked with Russell Watson for a long time, and Mike is the person who actually suggested to Russell's management you should take Robert. And Mike is now the godfather of my son and, you know, a dear, dear friend. And so it's funny how if you really, if your heart is saying, I've got to do this, I've got
yeah.
to find a way to do this. I do think it's one of life's magical mysteries
yeah.
that if you really firmly to your core believe that, something magical happens which you can't put your finger on.
No, and I completely agree. I mean, I look back on my life and I think there are some things that make no sense. And always at the moment, I mean, I come back to that whole for artists who, because often people, because I've run a portfolio career. So for instance, I used to run the BBC's induction program. So, you know, I ran that for years alongside being a broadcaster. So I see all these, you know, every week at the time, not, I don't know what the intake is now, but about 100 people coming in every week, all bright eyed and bushy tailed going, yes, you know, I've finally joined the BBC. And I think to myself, doing all of those things, just juggling all of those connections, you can't, what is it? You can't manufacture.
No.
There are lots of things that come out. I remember lying and listening to the World Service at one point. This was in Nigeria. I think, gosh, I'd really like to work for the BBC. And then I, you know, worked for the BBC for years and years and years. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I think you have to keep, whether you have some sort of religious or spiritual thing, but you have to kind of keep your spirit open.
Mm.
It's the only way I can describe it. Mm. You have to be willing to say, I am open to potential. And I think sometimes we so live in the world of facts that we forget that there is magic in life. And magic in life, and I quote unquote, is about being open, is about, say, any of these people. I mean, I had someone call me for an audition the other day, and I said, how on earth did you hear about me? Because basically I'm not really auditioning for theatre, but, you know, I'll audition if someone calls me. And she was like, oh, I saw you like however long ago and I've remembered you. And I think the thing to be is to be fully yourself if you can at any point. And if you are then meant to be connected, you will be. I mean, I remember going for an audition. I really wanted to work for Radio 2. Like, I really wanted to work. And I've done bits for Radio 2, but I've always wanted a show on Radio 2.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I really like. And then I got a show on Radio 3 and I was like, yes! You know what I mean? It's kind of like, I just think you just have to kind of be open.
Yeah.
Be open, but also work hard, you know,
yeah.
and work hard at whatever your hand sees fit to do. So the other thing, like, people approach me and say, oh, can you do a talk about whatever, you know, about how do you balance being a creative with, you know, bread and butter stuff. And I've done, I mean, my gosh, the number of jobs I've done, you know, I've been a recruitment person. I've run the BBC's induction program. You know, I've just done all.
You did the voiceovers, didn't you?
I did voiceovers.
The BBC
I did
iDance.
BBC iDance.
Yeah.
You know, I've done all of that. And I think sometimes people think, oh, well, it's just all going to happen because I'm going to stay and I'm going to be an actress or I'm going to be a singer. No, it ain't, love. What you have to do is just put your hands to whatever your hand sees fit. There's no pride in it. If I have to be a cleaner, I'll be a cleaner. You know, I don't kind of sit there going, that doesn't determine or doesn't define who I am. I think the other thing is people often get hung up on labels. So people go, what do you do? And suddenly it's about being able to say I'm this or I'm that to someone as if to prove to them that you exist. I'm like, you know, I'm just me. I don't, you know.
Hence the broadcast, the journalist, the literature.
But that is just on the website. The way you said
it. I know, I love it. I love it. And talking about live literature curator, I mean, wow. I want to talk about jazz versus jukebox. So you've done this at Hoxton Hall and you're coming up to the 10th anniversary now on the 24th of May. That's quite a long time to look after a concept like this, to curate a concept for your onwards. So.
Yeah, so we started at Ronnie Scott's. We had a residency at Ronnie Scott's for 7 years. And again, that's about being open. I upstairs at Ronnie Scott's at the time, they were looking for alternative. They were looking for different things to put upstairs. And I'd met the MD and, the managing director or the, you know, CEO. Mm. And he had said, well, why don't you come in for a meeting? So I went in for a meeting. I just didn't know what I was going to. I mean, he was like, yeah, come in. Let's have a conversation. I was thinking, I have no idea what am I going to pitch him. And then I thought, things I love jazz and I love poetry. I'm just going to pitch that and see what happens. So I didn't even have a name. I just kind of went, you know, all these people, because when I think about the poets, I think about Langston Hughes. I think about, Jane Cortez. I think about all the beat poets. All of those kind of poetry often has a musical rhythm to it. And I was like, it'd be really fascinating to see what you could do if you combine jazz and you combine that poetry. And spoken word has been in existence for a long time here in this country. But no one, I think we came at it at a slightly different angle in terms of improvisation. So basically poets come in and the band improvise behind.
Okay.
So there's no set format per se.
Yeah.
So we did that. We were there for 7 years and then we moved to Hoxton Hall about 3 years ago. So we're 10 years in. I have to tell you, it is the most joyous but also the most challenging thing I have to do in my life. Yeah. Because you sit there, you have to organize it and you have to.
And it's once a month.
It's
a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. There's no funding, you know, so it's not like we're funded by anything. We're not funded. So you kind of, all the stuff about getting the word out, getting the artists have been amazing. I have to say the poets in London and further afield have been incredible. So it feels like family, but it's a lot of slog to get people into that building. Once they're there, they absolutely love it. And that's been an interesting thing. So there have been times where my brain's gone, oh. And then I'm like, but we've done 10 years of it. You know, we've done 10 years of it. My MD, Simon Wallace, has been amazing. My goodness me, talk about genius. The number of times I go to him, right, I want to do this song. And he goes, right, and he writes it all out and it's just there.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a genius at what he does, I have to say. But also all the artists that come along, and so you've got singers and you've got poets. The poets often improvise, but the singers come along and they go, oh, I want to do this. And often they don't come with their charts, you know. And so he's doing all this kind of work, which is incredible, and we've got a great band, and it's a lot of fun. And I crack really filthy jokes occasionally, and I love it. So, yeah. So we're marking our 10th anniversary on the 24th of May at Hoxton Hall. Tickets available, hoxtonhall.co.uk. And it's going to be a lot of fun. We've got an incredible lineup: Jacob Sam LaRose, who is one of the preeminent poets and teachers of poetry in this country. Anthony Anaxaguru, who is also, again, incredible. Bella Cox, who's a newish poet, but really vibrant. Shruti Chauhan, who is from Leicester. I was going to say Leicester, I'm not sure. But anyway, somewhere around there. And then we've got Tracy Jane Campbell, who is part of the Kingdom Choir, who sang at the Royal Wedding, yeah. Who, in her own right, is a phenomenal singer. I mean, I've never seen anyone turn magic the way she does. I mean, she just opens her mouth and people just, literally, you can see them. They become childlike. She's so phenomenal. So it's a really brilliant lineup. I'll be doing some singing and the band, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. So
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Poetry is one of the loves of your life.
Yeah.
But you don't write it.
No, I don't.
Why not?
Because I know I'm not a good poet. I used to write. I'm sure we all did write angst-ridden, poetry. But no, I don't.
The Girl Who Dumped Me was my favourite poem I ever wrote.
See?
It had a lot of meaning behind it, I'll tell you.
See? So, yeah. I mean, no, I'm definitely not a poet. But I love poetry. I mean,
So I'm going to disappoint you now and say that I have no experience in poetry whatsoever.
Okay, right.
I don't read poetry. I don't listen to it. I don't know. I mean, I guess the most famous poets, but you know, I really don't have any experience in poetry whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I need to be a convert, clearly. So what, I mean, I'll tell you one of the reasons why I don't experience poetry is because with music, I just put it on as I'm having a shower, when I'm walking down the road, if I'm sipping a glass of wine and having a conversation and it's in the background. And most of the time, for me, because I work in music, I tend to put music on to have in the background. I don't tend to have it as a primary focus.
Sure.
I'm not somebody who tends to sit there and listen to a Shostakovich symphony, you know, intently listening for the next G minor chord that's going to come up and then go, oh, isn't that beautiful? No, I tend to, that's not stereotypical me, because my life is really frantic and I don't, to be honest with you, have the time to do that at the moment. So, and I guess that's one of the reasons why I don't experience poetry, is because I can't put it on, have a conversation with somebody and have...
And it's in the background.
So how do you experience poetry? What's your process? Do you sit there and read it, listen to it? I mean, you don't write it, so what's the...
I read poetry. I find it, you know... The thing is, a poem can have the world in it. And so if, for instance, you like short stories, a poem is an even shorter story, depending on the poet or poetry that you're reading. I also, because of the jazz verse jukebox, get to experience poetry off the page. So I think there are two main schools, if you like, in this day and age. You've got poetry on the page, which is you pick up a book and you read it. And then you've got poetry off the page, which is the spoken word and often comes from the page, but often it's just, you know, it's about a performance, but well written. And I love both of those. And also because my background's in theatre, I'm very used to reading text. So you read poetry as you would text. So it's a...
That feels very natural.
It feels very natural to me.
It's like, I mean, short stories, you can go on to, you know, Amazon and buy Audible and download them.
Yeah.
Is there the same sort of service for poetry?
Yeah. I haven't had to do that because I normally pick up a book. But a lot of poets now are recording there are legendary poetry recordings. I mean, of all the poets, whoever you might... I was just trying to think of who I was... listening to the other day, you know, so you can get poets reading their own work. There's a whole catalogue of that. That's a whole world. I think I find poetry quite interesting because when I read it, I am reading it from my perspective. So the thing about, I mean, I listen to a lot of audio stuff. Like I've started doing this really weird thing where I'll buy a book. Hardback book. I mean, I really must stop doing this. Buy a hardback book and then think, oh, but I'll just listen to the audio whilst I'm cleaning and then listen to the entire book and not read the book, if that makes sense.
I do the exact same thing.
Do you?
I do.
Yeah, and you can do that with poetry. I mean, you just need to, you know...
So come on, give me a starting point.
Oh, gosh.
If for somebody, and for the listeners as well, who is not into poetry, apart from reading the odd little bit of poem that comes on the tube when you're sitting there, and they feature little poems sometimes on the tube in the carriages. Apart from that,
Depends. Oh my gosh, it really depends on what you like. So whether you like political poetry, whether you like love poetry,
I don't know. Give me a starting point.
Oh, Okay, I would say I would go. I would always go for a collection. Then I wouldn't necessarily go for one poet.
Okay.
So there's a new publication called Bad Betty Press. They have just released a book called The Dizziness of Freedom, which is skewed towards mental health, but actually has a lot of contemporary poets who are very interesting, very, you know, on the scene now. That's one thing I would recommend. I would recommend Raymond Antrobus. I think his current book is called The Preservation. I might have got that wrong. Raymond has just been, he's just won several awards. One of them, I think one of the T.S. Eliot Awards things. And he's interesting because he is a brilliant poet, but he's also a poet who has a hearing disability.
Oh.
And he has explored that in terms of, and also he loves music. So he's explored all of that in his writing. Anthony Anaxagru, who I've mentioned before. I mean, gosh, there's so many.
That's enough to start with.
Yeah, I know. I'm just thinking of, I was just have to think of a female. There's so many. Mary Jane Chan. I mean, my gosh, the list is. If anyone is interested, email me and I'll send you a list.
Okay. Now, look, you're very busy. You juggle a lot. Just in case I haven't mentioned it already, broadcaster journalist.
Oh, stop doing that!
So I asked you in advance the tips and tricks to remain ultra productive, and it's and I love this list. I really do. You sent me this email and you said consistency, avidly curious about the world, willing to learn, read a lot, work hard, say yes more than no, know your limits, always have ideas, embrace a 24-hour clock, be hopeful and have dreams. And listen, I mean, that's like a mantra of life. I mean, it's an incredible list. I mean, I want to sort of print that out and put it above my bed.
Oh,
and
bless
read it.
You.
I love it. Most of them are self-explanatory. All of them I agree with. The only question I have is the embrace of 24-hour clock. What you meant by that?
I think it's because I've worked in different times, you know. So in radio, I've worked at 10 p.m. till 2 a.m., I work now, you know, get up at 3:30 on a Sunday morning. And so the idea that, and this may be more for me than for anyone else, because it can be quite tiring, is that if someone says to me, can you do a 5 a.m. show? I'm not going to go, oh my God, that's 5 a.m. I'm just not. I'm just going to go, let me check my diary.
Mm.
And I think we live in that world. And it's also important to recognize that the world is a 24-hour clock, that just as you're going to bed, Lin-Manuel is tweeting, good morning. Do you see what I mean? It's all of that kind of stuff. And so I think we have to have that notion now, and that there are will always, particularly in my industry, there are people who will always be awake at whatever time.
Mm. And just for those of you who don't know, Lin-Manuel is the composer of Hamilton, amongst other things.
Just love Hamilton.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
I've seen it like four times.
Really?
Oh my gosh, it's like my favourite musical.
Well, I'm addicted to the score. I've been listening to the score consistently.
Yeah.
And I'm blown away by it.
Yeah.
Really, I have to be honest with you. I think it's probably one of the cleverest pieces in musical theatre I've ever heard in my life.
It's phenomenal
and
to
commercial
see, like,
and catchy. I mean, that's the interesting thing is that you can. There's a lot of theatre which is clever, but it's not commercial and it's not particularly easygoing. It's not. And he's managed to find a way to be really clever, but also to be really commercial and clear and catchy. And God,
I think he is an extraordinary. I mean, I saw in The Heights as well, which I enjoyed, but not as much as I did. I mean, Hamilton, I'm like, when can I next see it? That's how much I like Hamilton, even though I've seen it four times. I'm like, let me see another 6 months and let me see whether I can get to it. It's interesting because I'm a fan of his work, but I'm also a big Sondheim fan. I love Sondheim. Last night I went to see Follies again for the fourth time or something.
I haven't seen it yet. I know. Everybody says you've got to see it.
God.
I know. I know.
Oh, do you like Sondheim?
Yeah, I love
Sondheim. Oh, my God. Yeah. So
I didn't see Company either. I didn't.
No.
I completely missed it. I was away Most of it.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, I could go off. Sondheim, I adore Sondheim. I don't even know how I got into Sondheim, but I really adore Sondheim. So, Company, I've seen. I saw Company with Adrian Lester a long time ago. I saw the current, you know, the one with, oh, gosh, what is her name? Lead female.
Yes, I know.
Not Marianne, the other. Anyway, everyone know who I'm in, but we'd be shouting now, going, Lapone, Patti Lapone, who I just think is extraordinary. So I love Sondheim, and Sondheim also has that wordplay. So when you talk about poetry and about how people use words, that's what I mean for me, that's what poetry is about. And Hamilton, or Lin-Manuel, does exactly the same as Sondheim, the way they use lyric, or, I mean, obviously, they have lyricists, but, I mean, Lin-Manuel writes his own, but it's that lyric that makes it
I don't
so
understand how you stand to the side. I love it. All those little catchy...
yeah, those little
really
things, I mean,
simple,
like,
but beautiful.
Just, yeah. Anyway, so...
Oh. Well, I think what I'm going to do is, your tips and tricks, I love it so much, I'm going to create a PDF, put it on my website. So if you want to download it, it'll be on the podcast page on the website. I promise you I'll do that, because I think it's a great list and everybody should buy it. And you'll say yes. And, I mean, you know, there's that great, well, slightly great, also slightly dodgy film with Jim Carrey, the Yes Man or whatever it's called. I mean, it's a funny concept. It's an odd concept. And I don't know anybody who's actually tried to do it. So you already told us about that the bark was difficult, and maybe in hindsight that was a yes, it should have been a no. But I mean, has there been anything else this year where you've said yes to where normally you would have said no, and you thought, God, this is amazing, I'm so glad I've had this mantra for 2019, say yes more than no?
Well, I mean, I tend to say yes. I mean, I tend...
Apart from this podcast, of course.
Apart from this, it's the podcast!
Yes.
I said yes to Robert's podcast, and I am so delighted I did.
I'm glad you said that.
So I think I tend to say yes a lot anyway. Although, I mean, I'm not an easy yes. I need to just clarify that, because people say things that I say no a lot. If I just think that's just...
But you're happy to throw yourself out of the comfort zone.
But I'm happy to throw myself out of my comfort zone, because I think that gives life its fizziness.
Mm.
So you're not just sat there like, you know, stale water. You're actually, you know, it kind of gives you that... I like that, the notion of being slightly uneasy, even though I don't like it when I'm in it, if that makes sense. But I like the notion of being slightly uneasy and being challenged.
You've been in the business now for
quite a while.
If I had to ask you what you think the business will be like in 20 years' time, in general entertainment business, nothing specific, what do you think will be happening?
I think we can't overlook the role of technology and the way it is affecting the business currently. I think VR and just the way technology is developing will have an impact. I think
do you think radio is in danger? Because podcasts are becoming more and more popular, aren't they? And I suppose the sort of talk or phone-in shows and the current news cycle, you know, that one would thought would never go away.
I don't think that's going to go away. I think talk radio is here to say. People like to talk. Excuse me. I think they like the idea of their voices being heard. But an appointment to listen is changed already. I know very few people who will get up and say, I'm just going to listen to this program, because they know they can time shift it. What does bring us together are the big events. So where, for instance, if someone important dies or there's been some sort of tragedy, sadly, people then gather around their radio or gather around their television. And interestingly enough, because radio is more portable than the television, although having said that, nowadays we have mobile phones, so often you can see the breaking news story. And you have to bear in mind all that technology. That technology is changing our habits, our viewing habits, our listening habits. And so it's the advantages are that it is easier to get to be seen or to be heard if you hit the right pocket, if you like. At the same time, it is also easier to be ignored because there's so much noise.
Yeah.
And that noise is a constant noise now. And there is a generation of young people who all they know is that level of noise. So how you get how you are heard above that noise is an interesting thing. So I think about all the current, for instance, you look at people like Stormzy, you know, contemporary music and how that is changing. It's quite an interesting thing to see how their voices are being heard. And you think about things like Radio 1, you can see they're having to change tactics. I mean, gone are the days now, although I'm still all right at the moment, where you get into a radio studio, there won't be any cameras. Now you get into a radio studio, there are cameras everywhere. You're like, yeah. You know, well, certainly Radio 1, you know, you're being filmed and you're being, you know, it's all of this kind of multi-layered stuff. So some of it's great, and some of it is erasing the imagination. That's the thing that worries me, that you see everything. As opposed to your imagination is sparked because you hear something. What do you think in your industry as a conductor, composer, what do you think? Just putting that question back to you, I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on that? Do you feel that it will change?
From a theatrical point of view, I'm really nervous about producers spending less and less money on bands in pits, and the number of shows which have started with a decent sized band and the producers year after year cut and cut. I mean, they're doing it with Les Mis at the moment, and they've already done it from when it moved to the Palace to wherever it is now.
Had a very interesting conversation with Trevor Nunn about that,
I think it's disgusting. I mean, that's my honest opinion about it. I won't mince my words about this, because I think musical theatre, the first word in that is musical.
Mm.
And I think the notion of, you know, having three people in a pit and pretending you've got a symphony orchestra down there because it's all pre-recorded, I really don't like that. And I think that's a really dangerous thing for the musical theatre. Orchestras really have to work hard at being more inventive, being more open to new, fresh ideas. And also, I think orchestras need to cross-pollinate, whatever the right word is, into other genres. And just like radio, as you've already mentioned, you've got TV cameras in there, and you know, you're constantly seeing on social media clips. I think with orchestral music, they have to be a bit more inventive. And there are orchestras, particularly like the Philharmonia, who are doing that. But I think there's a long way to go. I think we're in such a change at the moment in the industry with pop music, in terms of how musicians make their money. I think it's going to take another 10 years to settle down. Everything has to change. I just hope that the river flows in the right direction.
And what do you make of the idea that, and less about musical theatre, although to a certain degree this also applies to it, but also classical, that it's elitist, and therefore the audience that you potentially have to engage with it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, because it is not really focusing on the idea that there is a broader audience that may not know all the things you're meant to know about classical music, but potentially could be your new audience.
This is exactly one of the reasons why I created my blog and the Backstage with Robert Emery idea, because I want to knock down any barrier about the idea that classical music or any type of orchestral music or to a lesser extent musical theatre is elitist, because I don't think it needs to be. I personally love
but it doesn't need to be, but it is.
But I mean, I've always fought against this. I love talking to audiences. Sure. It's one of the things I've always wanted to do and enjoy doing. And I love explaining about a piece of music and then performing it. I love explaining what was the state of mind of the composer, why he wrote something, what the story was behind it.
Sure.
I think it makes listening to the music more understandable, especially if it's a classical piece of music which might last 40 minutes and you go, well, what's behind this? I mean, it's beautiful, but what's behind it? And it's really interesting. You know, I for several years now, I've pitched concepts to radio stations, to TV stations, to live event producers about trying to break down this barrier, as it were, and come up with what I feel are interesting concepts about pushing classical music in a new direction. And I've hit a lot of resistance over the years. And I hope it changes. I really hope that, I mean, there's a new, you know, the Scala Radio, which is the new radio station. You know, I think it's a great idea that they mix pure classical music with other orchestral music. The thing is, it's brand, isn't it? The brand is the issue. My sister-in-law is an interesting one because she'll openly say she doesn't like classical music.
Okay.
But I can play her a piece of music that she's probably heard on TV or on a film or as a radio underscore or whatever. And she goes, oh, yeah, I like that. I really. So I said, well, you do like classical music. It's just that you don't like the brand of classical music.
Mm.
And that's where we need a PR god to change the image of classical music.
And also, I mean, but I also think that the thing about when people say creative, I think it's also important to note that for some people, it is not about being at the forefront of playing or singing or speaking. Some of it is actually about supporting or being part of the infrastructure that enables people. Mm. And, you know, it is lovely to see people do that. And I think it's a very important thing to be able to say there are a plethora of jobs that you can do in the creative industries and be as creative as whatever. You know, the fact that you someone could be a project manager and actually work out creatively what needs to happen, who needs to be where, at what time, and all of that kind of, that is a creative way of working. It's being able to have that vision and say, yeah, okay, if we do this, we will achieve X, Y, Z. And that's also as important.
And you never know where it's going to spark off. I mean, it's funny, somebody was saying to me, in 50 years' time, what will be the classical music? And I was saying, well, actually, I think people like John Williams will enter into that category. And I think in 150 years' time, you'll be able to legitimately put somebody like John Williams next to Rachmaninoff. Talking about music and the rest of your eclectic career, what do you... You've said that you would like to record another album.
Yeah.
But what else do you still want to achieve in life?
Write a novel. I've just been taking some creative writing. I've just done one. I'm going to be doing a year-long sort of creative writing course. I've done one season, I think, you know, which was absolutely brilliant.
Well, keep me posted. I can't wait to find out what the idea is.
Might not be exciting. No,
that is also true. How do people find you? What's your social?
So my social is, well, it's just my name really, Jamoke Fishola. It's Jamoke Fishola on Insta. It's Jamoke Fishola on Twitter. Do you know, I suddenly realised I don't know what... Yeah, it's always just my name. If you type in my name, my website comes up straight away.
So you're on Twitter, Insta, and Facebook, you?
I'm Facebook Jamoke Fishola Music. So I have quite... I have some, you know, settings.
And it's hoxtonhall.co.uk.
So if you go on Hoxton Hall and it's Jazz Verse, as in verse, jukebox, and that's 10th anniversary. It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
I mean, you should be very proud that you've had that for 10 years. I mean,
that's
a real achievement. I mean, I know from organising gigs how unbelievably complicated and time consuming they are. So that's a real...
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that, Robert.
Jamoke, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And there we are. I'd like to say thanks very much to Jamoke for giving her time to come and have a quick chat with me. It was thrilling to hear her, and I do hope you can all get down to Hoxton Hall and see her at some time. She's there once a month, and it's an incredible event, so I would thoroughly recommend it. Once again, I'd like to say thank you to Lat56. They are our supporters on the Robert Emery podcast, and they are a fantastic luggage company. I'm about to fly off to Rotterdam this week, and I'll be using them all the way. So that's lat56.com. But for now, ciao for now.